the scenes, because we get so caught up in our life's expectations that it's easy to get lost there. And if you don't know what you've come into the world with, you'll never find your purpose, it would seem.
Well, you know, it's been said that the purpose of life is a life of purpose. And that brings us to the fourth one, actually, because what it refers to is, we talked about it briefly before, attending to this arising moment, which is finding our purpose in this moment and living purposefully. Otherwise, we just wander around. You know, in the Peaceful Warrior movie, there's that phrase that they put in, which, you know, we've all heard, that life is really about the journey, not the destination. Because if we're climbing a mountain, by definition, we fail every step, because we haven't reached the top yet, if that's our goal. We failed to reach the top. But if we redefine the journey as each step being a success, every step in the right direction, no matter how small, then each step is a success. And we're having constant success if we make even the smallest progress, day by day, moment to moment. So the quality of our moments is the quality of our lives, because that's what we control. We can always handle that moment. That is living a purposeful life. So even though life may be more about the journey than the destination, without a destination or a purpose, an aim, a goal in mind, there is no journey. We just wander around. It gives us a direction. You know, we're at point A. We got to pick a point B. We have to let go of one end of the pool if we're going to swim to the other side. So having an A, and you know, we're hardwired purpose drivers. Look at young babies. Young babies are constantly looking at things, reaching toward them, crawling toward them. They have simple desires. They want to get to it. They want the mother's breast. They want whatever. They want the keys, a jingle. So babies, it's very clear. But as we grow up, we start getting confused. Is this what I want or what I think I should do? And we start getting these dilemmas and conflict. We second guessing ourselves. Well, I want this, but maybe I should do that. It's a form of self-abuse. Because at some point we just make a choice, and we don't know we've made a choice until we act. Someone said, how do I know what I think until I see what I do? And for many of your listeners, I'd like to offer the reminder: thinking about doing something is the same as not doing it. At some point, we act. And the Peaceful Warrior's way, remember, it's our way, is about action. Not just thinking, not just fixing our insides and having just the right thoughts or feelings in order to live well. It's about asking, what will I do now? That's an essential part of living on purpose and the four purposes of life.
That's beautiful.
Is for the
it together in my mind too, when you said
about purpose. That special edition of Earthwatch was brought to you on recording, produced by Kathy Davis, instead of Robert Knights being here because of an unfortunate passing in his family. We wish him all the best, and thank you, Kathy, for having put that together for us. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, writer, editor, bon vivant, Paul Whitcover. Stay tuned. Good morning. So, as mentioned, this is Hour of the Wolf. I am Jim Freund. And, just when you thought it was safe to go back into the water or something like that is when we expected to be free of marathon fundraising and all that. Ah, but next week it starts again. They're calling it a mini drive. But I will, alas, will not be here. I will be leaving early for ReaderCon. I don't attend too many science fiction conventions nowadays, but ReaderCon is one that I really cherish and love, and it's lots of fun, and I go early so that I can do a little sightseeing in the Boston area. ReaderCon is just outside of Boston, and in years past, I've gone to, now I'm blanking on her name, the author of Louisa May Alcott's house and Ralph Waldo Emerson's house, where I was astonished to find Jeffrey Ford, the writer who teaches, in real life teaches, among other things, Emerson. He's never been to his house. It's like, come on, Jeff. And so forth. So I will be at ReaderCon next week. And if I have a show, if my show has not been preempted due to fundraising, which I don't know yet, Ken Gale will be here. And Ken will broadcast an interview with Gene Colan And my guest this morning knows more about Gene Colan than I do. Gene Colan was, my guest is Paul Witkover. Now you can say good morning and all that good stuff. Assuming I have chosen the right mic for you, I think I have. And try that. Say
good morning, everyone.
Oh, is that working? Yes, yes, it's working amazingly enough.
Excellent.
Yeah, first try out, and I got it right. First try out. I've only been doing this 39 plus years. So Gene Colan is a Marvel inker.
I don't believe he was an inker, but I don't remember exactly what he did. It was just a name that resonated in the depths of my teenage comic book unconscious.
And yeah,
I associated him with Tomb of Dracula, which in fact is what he's one of the things that he's known for, which an amazing run of comics, just beautiful, very atmospheric artwork. I recommend that to anybody. You probably find covers and stuff online, I'm sure.
No doubt. I didn't do a long search. Yeah. But if you really want to find out, tune in next week when Ken Gale will be here with a friend of his. I don't have all the details, but Ken will be here with an interview with Gene Colan. So there you go. Actually, I probably intend to tune in myself. After that, I don't know what happens. We are in fundraising mode through the end of July at that point, and back to normal programming in August. And I don't know when the fall drive begins. It may actually not be till October. That would be a pleasant break. Now, usually it's probably before October, because usually not pitching during October. But things are changing. At least we're hopeful that they're changing because, well, BAI needs to change to be able to survive. It's quite simple, actually. Announcements. Let's see. Really not a whole lot of announcements. Yes, Paul?
Actually, remember I had said that I thought that somebody associated with Tomb of Dracula had recently died.
Yeah.
In fact, it's Gene Colan.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he died.
Oh, that must be why Ken was promoting this.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's an interview, one would presume, done.
I know it's recent.
Yeah. Yeah, died on the 23rd of June.
Okay. And, I looked up Tomb of Dracula on Wikipedia. I did not look up Gene Colan, as I probably should have.
He was 84 years old and was a Bronx native.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ken Gale, you know, he may be an ornithologist and ecologist and stuff like that, but there ain't nobody in comics.
Well, you know,
who doesn't know him?
Yeah.
Except maybe you.
Well, I don't, but I'd like to meet him.
Wow.
But
you going to read it, kind of? Not.
Yeah, I am. Actually.
Oh, okay. Well,
I am. But it's weird because all of these names that you were so familiar with only as names as a kid, you know, reading comic books, Gene Colan, John Buscema, you know, all of these people that loomed as large as demigods, you know, to me anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think of them as aging. I think of them as a particular age forever.
So exactly.
It's a shock to
Which is the age when you were reading that book.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
So it's really, and I don't have that same reaction with authors of books that I read. It's, for some reason, it's just
That's interesting.
Books,
yeah. I would say that is true for me as well.
Yeah.
Very much so. Now, I was never the most voracious comic book reader, and when I did, I read The Weirdos, Howard the Duck, you know.
Yeah.
Although before that, my favorite was...
Well, you know what? Gene Colan worked on Howard the Duck, pretty sure.
That figures. Mm-hmm. That's probably where I saw the byline. But Howard the Duck was later, and I didn't follow comics too much after Howard the Duck went black and white to big size, mm-hmm. and black and white, and then to big screen.
Yeah.
But the Doctor Strange. Master of the Mystic Arts. That was my favorite.
And Gene Colan worked on that as well.
Of course he did. Okay, so it sounds like I knew him,
you did.
Knew his work a lot better than I realized.
You would recognize it.
But in those days, curiously, I never looked at the artist names as much as I did the writers, which I know is wrong when you're dealing with comics. And interestingly, also, see if they're coming into their own. There was a piece in the New York Times about the Kirby family trying to get a little of their own back, where Josh Kirby, one of the biggest names in the comics. Do I have the name wrong?
You mean you mean Jack Kirby?
Jack Kirby, thank you.
I thought you were referring to
No. I was trying to figure out the big name is Jack Kirby. Jack Kirby's family is involved in litigation for ownership of a lot of his characters.
Well, that's been going on for a long
time. No. This is renewed. This was major New York Times article in the last week. This is a renewed foray. And the funny thing is that apparently, according to the Times article, at one point Stan Lee was quoted as saying, none of these characters could have existed without Kirby. And now Stan Lee, who is on the other side of the corporate fence nowadays, is saying, well, he didn't do much of anything.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. But it's going to be very interesting to see. I think over the next few years, given the billions of dollars that the comics industry has turned into because of the big screen, it will be interesting to see who can maintain ownership of their characters. I mean, certainly our semi-frequent guest, and he'll be on again soon, Chris Claremont, who created a whole lot of characters for X-Men, owns none of it. Got paid nothing for the graphic novels upon which the movies are based that he wrote.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure you're right about that, because I know when I was working on comics, I did have partial ownership of the characters that I created, and what I was told was that the reason I had partial ownership was because Chris Claremont paved the way, basically, with his X-Men characters.
Really? Well, I'll have to ask Chris about that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him since last night, but...
And this didn't come up?
Actually, it did. Yeah. Actually, it did at one point, because Dave Roman, who was one of our readers last night, and his wife put out a little book, which was, I forget the Japanese word, but it's basically manga for teenage girls. And they did the teenage girl manga version of X-Men.
Hmm.
And Dave was one of our readers last night at the series that Paul, our guest here, was curator of, and once in future, at least guest curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And Dave, after doing his little show, was sitting next to Chris, and I say to Chris, Dave here has done a I think it was like Shingu manga version of X-Men. And Dave, do you know Chris? No, I don't think so. Chris Claremont. And the look on Dave's face was exactly what I hoped for. X-Men, yes, okay. So, and Chris, for those who don't know, is just, you know, like this really charming Brooklyn... lives, what, 8 blocks from you, something? We won't give away.
Yeah.
It's Brooklyn. All of Brooklyn is 8 blocks away from each other. From Paul. From Paul Witkover, exactly. So if you go to Google and you type in Witkover Place, you will see, you will then know that Wolverine cannot be far behind. Although Wolverine's a Stan Lee character, and Magneto is a Chris Claremont character.
No, I think Wolverine is a Claremont character.
It is, okay. Yeah.
But Magneto is not.
Oh, I
Magneto's an original...
X-Men. Well, yeah, Stan Lee X-Men.
He was a villain from the start, but he was definitely there in the beginning of the X-Men.
But Chris wrote the backstory.
Yeah.
The whole Holocaust
thing.
Yeah. So one of the reasons that I asked Paul on, aside from the fact that it's been way too long since he was on Hour of the Wolf, and certainly this is the first time in the new time slot, the non-Hour of the Wolf, Hour of the Wolf, is because I knew from well over several years ago that you are a huge Green Lantern fan.
I am. I cop to it freely.
Yeah. And I knew virtually nothing about Green Lantern. And when I knew that the movie was coming out, I purposely stayed away from, you know, even web pages that described it so that I could walk into the movie blind, as I think the majority of people who are going to see it are. I don't think that many people are that familiar today with the mythology that is the Green Lantern mythology.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's he's a character that's gone through a lot of changes since, you know, the Golden Age when he first appeared. A very different form. I mean, a different name, a different costume.
There's a different character.
Well, a different character is what I mean.
Yeah, truly.
Not Hal Jordan, which was the Silver Age Green Lantern, but Alan Scott.
Alan Scott. And Hal Jordan is the character in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. They based it pretty closely, actually, on the whole Silver Age mythos, and which is, you know, basically the crash landing of an alien spaceship and carrying a Green Lantern who sends the power ring out to find a man without fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't bring back Daredevil because that would be the Marvel universe.
Right.
It'd be an interesting crossover. But instead, they bring back Hal Jordan. And, you know, as the years go on, it develops that there's other people without fear, too, who become alternate Green Lanterns.
Yeah, there could have been, in fact, another person who was a green, who could have, on Earth, who could have been a Green Lantern, but the ring found the closest qualifier.
Yeah, although that doesn't come out in the movie. I mean, I didn't exactly have high expectations, and the movie didn't disappoint me. You know, I felt it to be a mediocre, you know, middle of the road type superhero extravaganza. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the spectacle.
Well, see, that's the thing is, I enjoyed it. I won't say, oh wow, what a great movie or anything like that.
No,
but I would say, hey, I had a good time.
Yeah.
I would tell people, do not spend the money on the 3D in this movie. It doesn't, for me, it really didn't add much.
Well, yeah,
I spent $5 more.
Yeah, that bugged me. I don't think it's necessary either. So.
And there are some films I've seen in which the 3D really adds something. They tend to be animated, although Up wasn't one of them, but Coraline was, and a couple of other. A Toy Story, it didn't make a big difference to me, Toy Story 3. But I have seen 3D look good. And, of course, Avatar. Avatar really made a difference.
I thought it did make a difference in Avatar.
Yeah.
I mean, setting aside the, you know, other merits or lack thereof of Avatar, I thought that 3D was really spectacular.
I just thought that Avatar was a thrill ride, like a roller coaster. And I wouldn't mind doing it again, but if it didn't have all the elements of that roller coaster, if it isn't big screen, if it isn't 3D, it's disposable.
Yeah.
The story is disposable. The acting is disposable. It's disposable fluff, but it's such cotton candy. It's such an extravaganza.
Well, I mean, you can see with that movie, and you can see with Green Lantern, and you can see with Thor, that, you know, the part of the mentality behind it all is you've seen the movie, now ride the ride.
Yeah.
You know, there's some coming to a theme park near you.
Well, in the case of Thor and Green Lantern, not as much Avatar, they have an exact common purpose, which is to get to the conglomeration movie. On one hand, it's the Mighty Avengers, and on the other hand, it's the Justice League of America.
Yeah.
And that's what this is all about. So, I mean, why else would they be making a Thor movie and a Captain America movie on the Warner Brothers Disney Marvel side of things, versus the let's see, is it Warner Brothers just doing the Marvel movies, or is it Disney? Disney owns Marvel.
Disney owns it, so.
Well, they own Marvel.
Yeah.
But who's releasing the films? It just occurred to me that's.
I don't know.
No. Warner Brothers is national. Batman is definitely Warner Brothers.
Yep.
Superman is Warner Brothers. There's no two ways about that.
Yep.
So, but I don't remember on any of the. You see a Marvel Studios logo at the beginning of every Marvel movie, but you don't see a Disney logo.
No.
But that doesn't mean it's not Disney.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, the most important thing, Chris Claremont telling the story of when the people, Chris isn't at Marvel at the moment, but he was there when when it was announced that Disney was taking it over, and, you know, somebody from Disney came in, they're all expecting the worst, and, you know, you all have to move out to the West Coast and wear funny hats or something like that. And they said, you know, we're going to be pretty much hands-off and all that, but now you all, your paychecks are going to come from a different place and all that. And he said, and Chris said, there was absolute silence in the room until one person raised their hand, and the person from Disney said yes, and that person said, benefits? And the guy said, oh, you get all the benefits that everybody at Disney gets, and hats were thrown in the air, and there was jubilation throughout the land. I thought that was a great story.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the reality of, you know, who owns who.
Yeah.
But having, they're making these movies as conglomerations, obviously. But the thing is that I have a screener of Thor. I did not go to the movie theater to see it. And I have to admit, I stopped watching after half an hour.
Did you?
It did not enthrall me. It didn't bore me.
Yeah.
It just didn't bring me in.
See, I put it in the exact same category as Green Lantern, and they're very similar, you know. Even
maybe I should give it another chance. I still have the screener.
Well, one of the things, I mean, it's a horrible movie from the aspect of story. I mean, just like they do with Green Lantern, they try to cram so much of the mythology into one movie while setting the stage for, you know, whatever.
For the Samuel Jackson, yeah.
Sequel, and then the Avengers or the Justice League in the case of Green Lantern. I mean, it's like overkill. But if you kind of grew up reading Thor and reading the Jack Kirby Thor and his vision of what Asgard looked like, and, you know, the buildings and the armor and this weird technology that they had that was not just, you know, indistinguishable from magic, but just really cool-looking, gargantuan, you know, contraptions that seemed invested with extraordinary power, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They got that down pat in the movie.
I mean, yeah.
Those costume and set were...
No, I mean, those looked good. But I was also underwhelmed by Hulk.
Yeah, I didn't see the new Hulk.
I never saw the Ang Lee one, although everybody calls it such a disaster. I'm curious to see it.
I thought the Hulk parts of that I thought were quite good.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I don't think Ang Lee makes bad movies.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, some are better than others, but I'm curious to see that. But the Marvel edition of the Hulk did relatively nothing for me.
Yeah.
And including the special effects, by the way, were not spectacular.
Yeah.
Green Lantern, I really liked the retro look. I liked the artwork. There is something that people rarely discuss, and I don't know what this is, but in all CGI movies, a sort of a gray, silver, with a slight bluish tinge palette to all films that use a lot of CGI background, from Sherlock Holmes to Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which is a Cuaron film, to most Marvel films. There is always this hue, and I assume this has something to do with what makes the CG, the computer graphics, possible. Green Lantern uses a and that hue, by the way, is not in Avatar, which was, you know, had its own technologies built for it. Nor do you see that color too often in Lord of the Rings, which has a lot of CG as well. But in Green Lantern, they have a totally different palette. It's a green, black, as befitting the artwork.
Yeah.
And the bulbous heads of the aliens, which all the critics were making fun of, I thought, wow, this harkens to a 1950s comic book or pulp magazine.
Well, like I said, I mean, they keep very close to, you know, the Silver Age vision of what Green Lantern was.
But in this case, literally the vision.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Guardians of Oa, you know, Hal Jordan. I mean, the guy they got, what's his name? Ryan Reynolds or something?
Ryan Reynolds, yeah.
Something like that. I mean, he's a weird-looking guy because he's so perfect in every way.
You yeah.
know, he's so perfect, he's bland. He's bland with perfection. I mean, I thought he was okay, but he didn't grab me because there was nothing distinctive about him, which I think may be one reason why I didn't like
him. He was a little bit, I liked him overall, and I liked the subtle humor. You see, here's the thing, is that I think there was a certain amount of subtlety to Green Lantern, and subtlety, I think, is lost in these big, blaring movies.
Yeah.
So that I think the idea that he's an underachiever, he's not Tony Stark. Like Tony Stark, he's not a perfect person. Tony Stark is Iron Man, by the way. And those movies, by the way, I liked.
Yeah, those movies are great.
Those are well-written, and Robert Downey inhabits that role. He personified that role. He gave it real character. The Hal Jordan of Ryan Reynolds' Hal Jordan is a schlub.
Well, he has less to work with as an actor because, again, you know, going back to the comic book, Tony Stark really, they Marvel put him through the ringer. You know, he developed an interesting personality.
Yeah.
DC tried to do the same thing with Hal Jordan, but basically they didn't succeed, I don't think. I mean, they turned him into, you know, first a mass murderer and then a galactic supervillain and then a kind of guardian angel, and finally now he's back as one of,
he's human again.
Yeah, he's a
member of the Lantern Corps again.
I guess. But I guess, you know, one way to look at it is, you know, there were all of these kind of earthbound superheroes and superheroes that were all about, even if their powers kind of involved science, they weren't really what you would call science fiction, I don't think. But Green Lantern
is science fiction.
Yeah, he was science fiction in the way that science fiction was.
At least when the Silver Age came about.
Yeah.
And I think Alfred Bester, was he not one of the people largely responsible for shaping?
Well, he worked on
the Green Lantern in that era.
Yeah, I mean, he worked on he wrote for the comics, and he wrote some Green Lantern stuff. And I've even heard, I don't know if it's true, that he's responsible for the, you know, the famous oath.
Everybody but one person says that he is responsible for the oath in Darkest Night and Brightest Day, this postman will not be.
Exactly.
From his rounds, his appointed rounds. And Alfie told me on the air many years ago, since he passed many years ago, it had darn well better be many years ago, he told me he wrote it.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Wikipedia entry, one person, they say, according to F. Gwynplaine McIntyre.
I did see that.
He did not write that, you know, because Alfred Bester told him, no, that was already in place. And Froggy Gwynplaine, Froggy McIntyre, as he was known before his very, very bizarre death about, I guess, 2 years ago at this point. He burned his apartment with himself in it, and never mind the people in the surrounding apartments that were burning down as a result as well.
Nobody else was killed,
but their property according to the New York Times, was harmed and stuff like that. So, in other words, he just set a blaze.
Yes, he did.
And you know, he wouldn't be around to worry about that. And he was a very strange guy. He
no,
was
the, I wouldn't consider him to be a trustworthy source.
Yeah, exactly. He was the only... I remember he read for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. I don't remember who the curator was, but I can tell you the date. It was September 10th, 2001.
Ooh, wow.
Okay. And he got up to read. And in the middle of the reading, he just collapsed to the floor. He just fell down in an unlikely faint.
Hmm.
He swooned.
Yeah.
I would not say he fainted. He swooned.
You don't see too many good swoons anymore.
No, you really don't. But he swooned well. And it got a bit of commotion, and then he said, got up and said, no problem, and continued his oration.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a reading. It was an oration. And before that reading, I got, it was at the New Vineyard Theater at the time, and I got in from Brooklyn fairly early. So I hung out for 2 hours before the reading at the World Trade Center and then went to the reading. And 12 hours later, the World Trade Center wasn't there anymore.
Right. Wow.
So that's how, so it's easy to remember the date. That Froggy, I'm not drawing. I mean, you know, unlike many people on WBAI, I am not drawing conclusions between the two. Although
right.
I think other people on BAI take note.
Yeah.
Take note that you know, Froggy Gwynplaine was vaguely involved with the World Trade Center the day before it was destroyed. And then 10 years later, you know, burned down his apartment.
Hmm.
Okay. This is WBAI in New York City and at WBAI.org, and only we would find the truth behind that to be alarming. Now that we've just been shooting the breeze for a little while, and bearing in mind that we already have less than an hour left of the show, it's a very different pace this time slot. The 2 hours flew by at 5 a.m., but 1:30 at night, it just moves on by. We should tell you the listener, Paul, about you, Paul Witkover.
Well,
who am us anyway?
Tell him.
Okay. Well, one of the first things that I always remember, and I don't know why, but it's because I'm always interested in things geeky and nerdy, is I think of, aside from writing a whole bunch of good books, including a Dracula tie-in, and see, now it's without it in front of me, it's not, is it Jill came? No.
It's
not Jack and Jill, no.
Well, Jack and Jill are in it. It's
yes,
it's
they are.
Tumbling After.
Thank you. That's the title.
Yeah.
And really a good read. Really.
Well, thanks.
I like that book a whole lot. And blogger. I remember iPublish.
Oh, yeah. That was 10 years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago, I guess.
Uh-huh. Yeah, long before another company decided to prefix everything they did with an I, being iApple, I this and I that and all that. iPublish was there first. Although there was an iPhone 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, they were not the first to stick a little
Cisco.
I.
Cisco. Cisco had the iPhone. And I don't know if they've settled yet with Apple over the use of the name. Rumors have gone back and forth about whether there was a settlement or not. And you are, Paul was a curator for the reading series that I am executive curator of.
I curated the readings for, I guess, a little more than a year. That's about right.
I was going to say 2 years.
2 years? That
yeah.
could be.
I was going to say 2 years. And glory years they were. We had a lot of good people.
Yeah, that was a fun time.
Yeah. And have to get you to do another. In my head, half of next season is already going, so we have to get you in there. Oh, and I should just announce that in August, our readers are going to be Keith DeCandido and Laura Ann Gilman. So it will be a fun evening in August, and we're not going to do September. And in October, we may do two readings, depending on availability and all that. But I can tell you that one of them will be vampire-related, and that our readers will be Susan and Clay Griffith, who have a very interesting series of books coming out from Pyre Books. And our host that evening will be Margot Adler, who has been on a huge vampire kick. She is, of course, creator of Hour of the Wolf. And what's her official title? I guess correspondent of National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, she's a producer at NPR. And she is vampire obsessed.
She's vampire mad.
She is. If you go to npr.org, you will see a list of over 150 books that Margot has read in the last year and a half, with annotations for, you know, loved it, hated it, a little essay here, a little thing there, on all about her journeys through through vampire land. You write novels, short fiction, tie-ins. You've been a translator.
Have I been a translator?
Haven't you? You told me a story about how you were working on a series.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't actually translation. That was, I worked for Tokyo Pop for a while, I would receive Japanese to English translations, but just, you know.
You're a post-translator.
Literal translations, and then I would turn them into
English. Yeah, and then they just decided to babelfish the whole thing.
They did. That's exactly what they did.
Yeah, which is astonishing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And this was prose.
Yeah. Yeah, this wasn't...
These weren't just computer instructions.
No, these were novels.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm so scatterbrained. What haven't I mentioned?
Well, I'm an editor.
That was just coming to mind.
Yeah, I'm a freelance editor, and I've also worked for publishers that I won't mention now. But although I will say that I edited most recently Michael Swanwick's new novel, which is just out from Nightshade.
Dancing with Bears. Michael was on the show 3 weeks ago.
A wonderful book. And
It really is. I hadn't finished it when he was on the show. Uh-huh. Shame on me. But I had such a joy reading that.
Well, it's a heck of a fun book. So, you know, those two characters, Surplus and
Darger,
are just really endearing in their I mean, there are a couple of con men in some warped but still recognizable future.
Constantly pushing east.
Yeah, it seems like it.
No. Yeah, that's intentional on Michael's. He is doing that on purpose.
Yeah.
And he has decided, because he has to do the research, next stop China.
Excellent. Well, they
so he can go back. That's the reason why.
Well, they leave a swath of destruction behind them. You know, they can only go east because the West has been destroyed wherever they are.
Yeah, exactly. And alas, the playing on demand of each show disappears after 2 weeks on the WBAI archive.
Oh, okay.
So you can hear tonight's show for another 2 weeks, but then in 2 weeks it will disappear. And the Swanwick show, as of the start of this show, I guess, disappeared.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. Well, yes, but, oh, ask nicely and we can, excavate
it.
We can excavate it if people send me an email. And I am trying to get together a podcast. But in order to do a podcast, I have to cut all the music out of the show.
Yeah.
Unless I can either use public domain music or Creative Commons.
Hmm.
Or music that a musician would donate to me and allow me to use.
Well, I hope you pursue that. I think that's a fantastic idea.
I have been pursuing it. I actually have a separate online repository for where the podcasts will go. But I have to, my website is so 90s.
Yeah.
I'm getting my chops back. I know HTML, I've been told to go to WordPress. And after taking a long, hard look at WordPress and speaking to people that keep WordPress alive, I've decided it's not for me. I'm not a blogger.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to use it as a platform for non-blogging stuff. I'm looking at alternatives, including Tumblr, really getting back into HTML5, various things. I'm not a programmer, but I am a web producer. So I'm looking at new tools. But not blogware. Now, you, on the other hand, are a very active blogger.
No, I used to be.
One of a gang of four, right?
Yeah. I was part of the inferior 4+1 blog with Liz Hand and Paul DiFilippo and Lucia Shepherd and Lisa Goldstein.
She has a new book out.
Does she?
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes.
Is that who's published that? Oh, that's Tachyon, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I did.
Yes,
know
it's
that.
Tachyon Publications, and that's right. And I was asking them about if she would be at ReaderCon. They said no, but Jacob, God, my brain is for Schlungit, the publisher of Tachyon, the editor and publisher of Tachyon. Well, he'll be there. Jacob Weissman will be at ReaderCon. I've already had him on my show. Funny story about that, I'll tell you off the air. But. So you're not blogging as much anymore.
No, it's too kind of time consuming.
It really is.
Yeah, and I find that other.
You've been Facebooking a lot.
Yeah, I Facebook a lot. I mean, that's a venue that seems more suited to the time I have available.
Mm-hmm. Because you can do it hit and miss.
Yes, exactly. Do it on the run over the course of the day. Don't have to really. I mean, for me, writing a blog post is it's a piece
it's
of
writing.
It's a piece of writing. It takes time. It takes effort, and I'm not getting paid for it.
That's right. And if you're a professional writer,
well, anytime
it takes a lot of time to say this is my craft and I want to be good at it.
Well, I think it would be one thing if I was more prolific as a writer, but I'm a very slow writer, and so the blog. Which serves as a platform to let people know about the publications of the members like Lucius and Liz and Paul and Lisa, who are more prolific than me. I think it serves a purpose there. But for me, it was just taking time away from working on my next book.
And at this, what is your latest book and what is your next book?
Well, my latest book is
what's in print. Let's just start with what's in print with your name on it.
That's a darn good question. I at this point don't think anything is in print with my name on it.
That's annoying.
Yeah, I think the collection from PS Publishing, which is a wonderful small press out of England, that collection came out a couple of years ago. It's called Everland and Other Stories. That might still be in print. That probably still is in print.
I think it is, actually.
Yeah, but yeah. As far as I know, nothing else is in print.
None of your novels? Not the.
No, Waking Beauty, which is my first book, is long out of print. In fact, I have the rights back to that myself. My plan is at some point soon to bring it out as an
e-book. Yeah.
My second book, Tumbling After, that you mentioned, that's a little more complicated. I mean, it's definitely out of print as far as print goes, but it's not out of print as far as ebooks go. So I'm not quite sure of arrangement with my publisher is there. I have to look at our contract. I'd like to get the rights to that back as well.
Yeah.
And then my third book was Work for Hire, basically.
Was the Dracula.
Yeah, Dracula Asylum. That was for Dark Horse, and that, I have no rights to.
One of the earliest
all.
Dark Horse books. They're actually been doing more now, haven't they?
Yeah, I don't know if it was one of the earliest, but, I mean, certainly they've pressed on since then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good experience, but
But it's Work for Hire.
Yeah, it's Work for Hire. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you care to read a short story?
Yes, I would love to.
Would you like to take a break first?
Sure.
Okay, well, why don't we do that? Before, as I search for a bit of music to take a break, let me tell people, by the way, that a friend of Paul's is involved in a costume dance party as a benefit for the Merry Wives of Windsor Terrace. I mean, you gotta love the name. I mean, I don't know if this is Shakespeare's worst play, but I don't love The Merry Wives of Windsor. It's a false Falstaff. It just has never done it for me. But it's so easily adaptable, and it's so much fun. I saw a country western version of The Merry Wives of Windsor and all that. But there will be an event for this. The theater in Brooklyn that is associated, the Brave New World Repertory Theater, and you gotta love the name again of the Repertory Theater. They've done some wonderful thing. They're doing a benefit this Sunday on July 10th from 5 to 9 o'clock at Shepherd's Hall Holy Name Church, 245 Prospect Park West. And tickets are not free, being a benefit, being a fundraiser. So what I will do instead is tell you how to find out more about it. Let's see. There is a well, you can follow them on Facebook or whatever. But what the best thing to do is probably to go to bravenewworldrep.com. That seems to be the thing to do. And that will lead you to a place where you can buy tickets or donate outright or whatever. So Brave New World Repertory Company this Sunday. It's a dance party. It's a costume dancing with a DJ and food and raffles and stuff. And it just sounds like, you know, a whole lot of fun. And I'm just feeling very old because this is all nostalgia for the 80s. And it's like the 80s. That was like last month, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's there to be nostalgic about in the 80s anyway.
Yeah, really. It's I like the cars, you know.
Yeah.
They were okay. Speaking of which, I'm supposed to be finding some music right now. So I'm going to go for one of my old favorites, I guess. Oh, and when I say old favorites, hey, it's even a bit of public domain music. So we'll be back. We were discussing Dracula Asylum, so here's a vampiric song.
Crawlers in a hole, get upon a trolley car, the car begins to sway. I sit upon a half a dozen laps across the day. I walk into the office and I greet the starter there. Six or seven elevators go up in the air. Sit down at my Remington and syncopate the keys. The fellow by the water stand gets water on the knees. The boss dictates a letter. Dear sir, I'd like to say, the man who gets the letter has to stop and hesitate. Now when the day is over and the sun sets in the west, say I'm the only little bird who doesn't go to rest, for I'm a jazz vampire. Take a tip, from me, for I am all the evil music has. I stood by the ocean, no one around, shook my shoulders and the sun went down, for I'm the meanest kind of jazz vampire. I'm the wicked vampire of the jazz.
The vibrant and always young Marianne Harris. I'm a jazz vampire from 1921, thereby making an actual bona fide public domain song. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor, brought to you over these airwaves since 1972, believe it or not. Although originally in the 5 to 7 a.m. time slot, and as of last November, first canceled and then reborn like a phoenix in this new time slot. So here we are now. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Paul Witkover, who is about to read some of his fiction for you. But, oh, yes, I was going to announce, by the way, for those who don't know, this Friday, if you are a subscriber to Starz television or have access to somebody who has it, and I suspect most TV series that run on Starz end up on Netflix. If you have streaming Netflix, Torchwood. Hi, Lester. Torchwood, Miracle Day. It's the now American-produced follow-up to Torchwood, which, of course, is a Doctor Who spinoff. But it's the same producer. It's written and directed by Russell Davies and Julie Gardner, who left the BBC in order to do this show. So, you know, Captain Jack is there and Eve Miles and husband, but it's a whole new, well, since most of Earth got incinerated in series three, we will find out it's the opposite in Miracle Day. We know one premise of the plot, one premise only. Previously, Captain Jack Harkness, the John Browman character, was immortal. He could not die. Well, now on Earth, nobody dies. Nobody can die. This is all we know of the plot. So Torchwood Miracle Day starts broadcasting on Friday for pay TV. But it'll find its way around over time.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
I'm sure it will. So what have you lined up for us?
Well, I'm going to read a story from my collection, Everland and Other Stories. This is a story that was published in a magazine you may remember called Night Cry.
Yes, I do, actually.
That was back in the 80s. Well, there's something to remember the 80s fondly for.
There you go.
This was actually the first, I consider it to be my first professional story, even though I sold a couple of stories prior to this. This is the one that I think of as my first.
Very good.
It's called Maya Land. The bar, called the Poco Loco, was dark and filled with tourists, mostly gringos. It was the kind of bar where drifters washed up and stayed for months, drinking and dancing in lazy eddies of movement and time. There was an incestuous feel to the place, a laconic desperation. A few hopeful glances swung toward Andrew as he entered, then seemed to lose interest. a mirror ball revolved above the dance floor, where a drunken middle-aged Indian man in native dress was swaying alone to the new wave beat. Andrew sat by himself in one corner, away from his countrymen and women. The things that mattered to Andrew, the Indians and the land, seemed timeless, unalterable. There was a spirit investing every tree, lake, and volcano, a spirit, ancient but still green, that bided with the strength and patience of stone behind every Indian face, just as the old temples persisted behind the mask of the jungle. Though crumbling and empty, defaced by tourists, the temples were still charged with life, as though they had been abandoned only yesterday by a people who had every intention of returning. The Guatemalans called their country the land of eternal spring, but it seemed to Andrew that whatever was essential to this country and its people, whatever had raised the temples and named the gods, was hibernating now through a long cold season, a winter of white men who would one day melt away. After a beer, Andrew looked up to see the Indian weaving over to his table. He was tall for his people, but his dark, handsome features were classically Mayan, thick lips, high cheekbones and forehead, and long, sloping nose. Andrew motioned for the man to sit down, glad to share his table with a local. He'd been dreading the intrusion of some 60s reject who would gripe about the country, then try to sell him bad dope. The Indian introduced himself as Victor. His Spanish was slurred, difficult to understand. He said something about the music. "I saw you on the floor," Andrew said. "You dance well." Victor nodded energetically. "I like that man. What is his name?" Andrew thought back to what had been playing. "David Bowie?" "David Bowie. Duran Duran also. You buy me a beer, okay?" "Sure." He walked up to the bar and ordered two beers. "Watch out for that guy," the bartender advised. "He's in here all the time hustling drinks." "He doesn't have to hustle me," Andrew replied. When he returned to the table, Victor took his beer and guzzled greedily. Then he gave Andrew a bleary smile. "You think I am drunk, yes?" The smile vanished. "Okay, so look here, my friend." His brightly colored woolen shirt was belted below the waist, billowing out into a sort of pocket at the belly like a kangaroo's pouch. From it, Victor took a handful of stones that he spread out on the table in front of Andrew. "Go on, pick one up." They were light. In fact, not stones at all, but large seeds of some sort, carved into faces. "Avocado pits," said Victor with pride. "I carve them myself. So I drink too much beer, too much quetzalteca. I am an artist." The detail of the work was breathtaking, seemingly beyond the power of Victor's shaky hands. Andrew was reminded of Mayan relics he had seen at Tikal and Bonampak. And in fact, he recognized among the carvings the monstrous faces of Mayan deities, Chak, the rain god, with his great hooked nose like an elephant's trunk, uplifted to spray water, the blank, saucer eyes and slack, buck-toothed mouth of the sun god, K'nitschahau, and the skull-masked Apuch. They were human faces of both Indians and gringos, yet even they seemed terrible, with expressions twisted to inhuman extremes of emotion, as if they had absorbed the attributes of gods, only to find their bodies too frail to contain them. "They're fantastic. Are they for sale?" Andrew asked. Victor opened and shut his mouth, groping for words as though he had been insulted. He seemed both angry and hurt. "What do you take me for?" he asked at last. "One of those peasants who haunt the old places to sell their worthless imitation relics to stupid gringos? Look in front of you. These are not lies made to look old. I did not come up to you and say, 'See what I have plowed up in my cornfield.'" He made to sweep the pits back into his shirt, but in his fury missed and scattered them to the floor. Andrew bent down with him to gather up the carvings. When they had finished, Victor seemed calmer. He was a proud man, but then he had every right to be. Andrew had not meant to offend him. He apologized. Victor smiled warmly. "I, too, am sorry. Again this night I have drunk too much. So for you, my friend, I will carve something special. Let us drink to friendship." Andrew brought two more beers. "Why do you sit alone tonight?" Victor asked. "Where is your girlfriend?" Andrew shrugged. "Too many tourists. If I'd wanted to see this kind of place, I would have gone to Atlantic City." But Victor was interested in one thing only. "That is bad. Even I, who am married, have a girlfriend." Andrew laughed. "My wife is across the lake in San Lucas. My girlfriend lives in Solola. Between the two of them, I will soon be a dead man." "What is it like in San Lucas?" Panajachel was proving too touristy for Andrew's tastes. In such places, he always felt ashamed of his country and angry at himself. "Ah, there it is beautiful and quiet, not like here. We fish and farm the land at the foot of the volcanoes, just as we have always done. There I do my carving. The women are like flowers, and the children are always singing. The soldiers have taken men from all the villages around here, San Pedro, San Pablo, San Jorge. but never from San Lucas. We are good workers. How is it possible to get there from here? Victor clapped him on the shoulder. Tomorrow you will come with me. Stay at my house. Andrew didn't think he would ever grow used to the spontaneous generosity of the Indians. At least, he hoped not. He accepted with pleasure. Where do you sleep tonight? Victor asked. Andrew said the name of his hotel. Tell them to wake you at sunrise. The first ferry to Santiago Atitlan leaves at 6. We must be on it if we mean to catch the ferry from Santiago to San Lucas. There is but one each week. Should we miss it, we must walk 16 kilometers. Where should I meet you? The ferry leaves from the Hotel del Lago Azul. Walk down to the beach and turn left. You'll see the dock. I'll be there. The next morning, Andrew woke with a hangover and had to hurry to catch the ferry, arriving just as it was pulling out. Victor was suffering, too. They greeted each other and sat side by side in silence as the noisy boat labored across the lake. This was Andrew's first trip onto Lake Atitlan. Soon he no longer noticed his hangover. The water was a deep, still blue over which the ferry passed as though gliding across glass. The air was clear and crisp. He could see across the lake to where the thickly forested cones of three volcanoes humped one behind the other like vast green pyramids. Faint smears of smoke drifted from the sides, and bits of orange sparked now and again. Victor explained that the farmers, who could not grow enough to support themselves on their own land, set these fires at night and then took possession of the resulting fields. There they would grow food crops for a season or two before the landowners decided the patch could more profitably support coffee and either hired or simply evicted them. The results of this process could be seen to the right, where a fourth, smaller volcano stood, its sides an orderly patchwork of plowed fields. As they drew closer to the opposite shore, Andrew could make out splendid homes tucked like castles amid unspoiled tracts of pine, the estates of the landowners and vacation homes of top army officers, according to Victor. Then the ferry rounded a bend, and Andrew saw the village of Santiago Atitlan. Dugouts from the village dotted the water to either side of them. The fishermen paused in the lowering of their nets and waved to the passing ferry. Andrew waved back. Up ahead, two rickety docks splintered out over the lake. A crowd of Indians in their bright costumes stood on one, waiting to load up for the trip back to Panajachel. It seemed as though the dock must collapse beneath their weight. More dugouts were drawn up to the shore around the docks, interspersed with heaps of seaweed left to steam in the sun. Behind the docks, the grass grew thick as the ground sloped sharply up to a narrow cobblestone street lined with modest shops, restaurants, and houses. Farther up rose the blue and green dome of the church, topped with a red cross. No sooner had he stepped from the boat than Andrew was surrounded by a flock of small girls who thrust bouquets of woven bracelets up into his face, chirping for him to buy. Victor waved them away. They dropped back, following at a discreet distance as Victor led Andrew to the San Lucas ferry. It turned out they had half an hour to wait. Victor stretched out on the grass to nap, but Andrew felt like exploring the town. Away from Victor, the girls beset him again. He tried to be firm, but in the end their dirty faces, full of the intense youth and beauty that passed over Indian girls like a shadow whose substance they would never know, persuaded him to buy a bracelet from each. Anyway, they made good gifts. Generally, he bought them from one group of girls, only to give them away to another. As he walked up toward the market, Andrew saw that the influx of tourists that had overrun Panajachel was spilling over into Santiago. This was perhaps inevitable, but still it saddened him to see how many stalls were hung with goods no Indian would buy. The market itself preserved much of its traditional flavor, however. Here Indians still traded with Indians. The atmosphere was boisterous but jolly, like a festival. The stalls burgeoned with plantains and vegetables, clay pots and clothes of synthetic fibers. The crowd was in constant motion. It was impossible to stand still without receiving a poke in the back. Nonetheless, groups of women held their own around certain stalls, gossiping as their dirty barefoot children chased each other and tussled underfoot. Now and again, a rooster loudly asserted its importance. Andrew brought some bananas for breakfast. On the way back to the ferry, he heard a sudden roaring on the road behind him and leaped aside. A truck sped by, filled with soldiers who stood uncomfortably squeezed together, rifles poking skyward. The oldest among them looked younger than Andrew. To a man, their faces were blank, without individuality or intelligence. The Indians quieted and kept their eyes to the ground until the truck had passed. Back on the ferry, he and Victor were the only passengers. As they ate the bananas, Andrew asked about what he had seen. Victor pointed toward the land they were passing, the same thickly forested slopes Andrew had noticed earlier. The army says there is danger through here from guerrillas. But isn't that the way to San Lucas? Victor nodded. Don't worry, there are no guerrillas. How do you know? Villagers die there, some gringos too, a while back. He fixed Andrew with his gaze. But never has a soldier died there. Andrew shook his head. I don't understand what's happening here. The guerrillas, the soldiers, you people in the middle. So much death wherever I go in this beautiful country. We do not speak of these things, Victor said. It is a stain on the memory of the Maya, Andrew said with feeling. I wish there was something I could do. Victor did not reply. He was carving an avocado pit. Half an hour later, the ferry docked at San Lucas. The contrast with Santiago Atitlan was considerable. Here the docks were empty, the streets deserted save for strutting chickens and wasted, scavenging dogs. There was no one to cry for Andrew to buy their wares. The houses were smaller and in poor repair. But Victor was all smiles as he hopped down from the boat. What did I tell you, my friend? Here the air is clear. To Andrew it smelled of cows and pigs. Now a few people were making their way down to the dock. The weekly ferry brought mail, as well as hard-to-find goods ordered from Panajachel. Victor knew them all. He sang out his greetings, and they answered in kind. Like Victor, they had pronounced Mayan features, more so than the Indians Andrew had seen in Santiago. Victor introduced them around. Then they set off for his home. It was a good way, somewhat outside of the village proper. All the way, Victor was talking, telling him who lived where, pointing out the local bar, the school, the place where, 15 years ago, he had fought and killed his chief rival for the hand of the woman who became his wife. They passed fields where women and children bent beneath the hot sun, over dusty furrows, porches where men relaxed in the shade sipping quetzalteca and spitting into the street. Victor called out to them all with pleasure. Whatever they thought of him in Panajachel, Victor was obviously highly respected in his own village. They stopped at a rickety wooden fence. Behind the gate, the ground was torn and muddy. A line of thin planks led up to the house, a dubious-looking amalgamation of dried clay bricks, tree limbs, and rusty sheet metal topped with thatch. Behind the house, Andrew could make out a leaning shack of rotten boards, the outhouse, and behind that, a chicken coop set round with wire that seemed in better condition than the house. Victor opened the gate and ushered Andrew through, kicking meanwhile at a weaselly piglet that had insinuated itself between his feet. It scampered off, squealing mournfully. The door to the house was wide open, as a consequence of which several hens were bobbing peremptorily toward Andrew as he entered. Startled, they careened about like cackling buzzsaws, causing him to step back into Victor. "They scare you, eh?" laughed Victor, pushing past him into the room. "Sit down, my friend." He kicked a small stool to Andrew, who perched atop it, his knees pressing his chin. Andrew was relieved to see that the inside of the house did not mirror the outside. Here the dirt floor was packed tight and neatly swept. In the center of the room sat a fat cook stove with a blackened pot on top. A hammock was slung in one corner. A wash basin and cooking implements hung from nails along the walls. There was a long table upon which rested an oil lamp and a small transistor radio with its innards spilling out. A sheathed machete leaned against the door. In another corner nestled a shrine to the Virgin Mary, draped with crepe paper and fronted by rows of festively colored candles burning down to puddles of wax. The space behind Victor was cut off by a curtain. Excusing himself, he ducked behind it, only to reappear seconds later, with his arms about the waist of a shrunken, smiling woman and two sleepy-eyed children, a boy and a girl. "My wife and my youngest, Juan and Concepcion," he introduced, laughing as the two children, neither of whom looked older than 10, pressed back into their mother's skirts, eyeing Andrew with something like awe. Andrew smiled and winked at them, provoking squeals of delight. Remembering the bracelets he had bought that morning, he reached into his pockets and held out two closed fists. "Go ahead," he said to the girl. "Pick one." Timidly, Concepcion inclined her head toward his left hand. When he opened it, she beamed with pleasure and took the bracelet. Emboldened by her example, Juan pried open the other fist and snatched the bracelet there. "Thank our guest," Victor directed. His son and daughter looked at each other, then ran out of the house without a word. "Thank you," said Victor's wife, smiling and nodding. Andrew waited for her to be introduced, but Victor merely guided her back behind the curtain. Then he took Andrew by the arm. "Come. There is a place I will show you." Andrew was tired, but he did not feel he could refuse. "Where are we going?" "To an old place up in the mountains. Don't worry, it will be safe. No one knows of it but me. I show it to you because I think you will understand." Victor filled two jugs with water. He gave Andrew a candle and kept one for himself. Then they set out. They climbed for hours up the side of a volcano that Victor called Atitlan. He did not know whether the lake had been named for the volcano or the other way around. It was hard going, their only companions the birds and lizards that fled before them into the thick forest. Victor led him down a ravine cut by a waterfall. Obscured by dense foliage there, an opening winked large enough for a man to crawl through. Victor lit his candle and entered on hands and knees. Andrew followed. "We must be noisy to frighten off the snakes," Victor said. Andrew had to force himself to continue. The air grew cooler and drier the deeper they went. After a time, he could not have said how long, the passage widened. Soon they could stand. Andrew gasped. Around and above him, illuminated by candlelight, the cavern vaulted out of rock and shadowy echoes of rock. Somewhere far away, water dripped. It was a Mayan site. Untouched by time or archaeologists, the walls were covered with painted glyphs and figures. Andrew brought his candle close. A red figure in a snake headdress held a man's head in one outstretched hand. Before him knelt his victim, chalky blue, blood spouting from the neck to form a lush green cornstalk. Close by, a woman passed a thick, thorny rope through her tongue, catching the blood in a bowl at her feet. In the center of the cavern was an altar, a round green stone ringed by carved skulls and inlaid with turquoise and shell. Behind it was a throne in the shape of a jaguar devouring a human heart. Steles stood around the altar, some marked with dates in the Mayan bar and dot system that Andrew could recognize but not read, others blank-faced. The terrible faces of gods and goddesses leaned out from the walls, as though the rest of their bodies would soon follow. There were four of the rain god, Chak, each facing a different direction and colored white, black, yellow, and red. Andrew turned to Victor, who was silently watching him. "What is, was this place?" "This is where I come to carve," he said. He placed his candle on the altar. Andrew did likewise. They sat facing each other. Andrew reached for the water, but Victor stopped him. He gave him the second jug, which Andrew had thought contained water. "This is balche. It is an old drink made from honey. Here we should drink what they drank." Andrew nodded. The balche was thick and heady. He felt as though he was taking part in some ancient ceremony. "I found this place as a child," Victor said. "At first it frightened me, but I could not keep away. I heard the builders of this place call out. Though my mind understood nothing, my bones shook with the old language. I listened and learned much. I came here and carved, thinking about what I had learned, and more became clear to me." "What is this place?" Andrew repeated. "Listen." Victor had taken out his knife, was carving an avocado pit. There was only the distant drip, drip of water. Andrew sipped the balch. His head was spinning. The candlelight flickered over the walls, making the scenes painted there come alive. It was not water dripping, but blood. It poured down the walls in red streams. Andrew screwed his eyes shut, but the vision persisted, and then he heard Victor's voice echo through the cavern of his skull. "You cannot escape the blood, my friend. That is why I brought you here, to understand from these things that what happens in my country today is not a stain on the memory of the Maya, as you put it, but that same memory, a living force still, for all it may be forgotten by some. This place, this country, this people, everything is soaked in blood, as much today as centuries ago." Andrew found that he had lost all feeling in his body. He felt as though he were floating in darkness, borne up by the steady voice. He could not speak. "We are the true guerrillas. The others merely do our work. Army or rebels, the gods are served." Andrew opened his eyes as though waking from a deep sleep. They were no longer alone in the cavern. All the Indians from San Lucas stood around. Some held torches. Others swung censers from which an acrid sooty smoke leaked, stinging his eyes and making them water. The smell of balche was strong. He looked down at his body. He had been stripped naked and painted a chalky blue. He still could not feel his limbs. He was being supported by two old men who wore masks of Chak. One of the men was painted yellow, the other red. Two more Chaks stood before him, black and white. Then he saw Victor. He was dressed like one of the figures on the wall. He took something from his belt and held it up for Andrew to see. It was an avocado pit carved with his likeness, only twisted by pain. "This is your god face," he said. "In this way you will be honored among us, my friend." He paused, then added, "You asked what you could do." Then the four Chaks grabbed hold of him by his arms and legs and bent him back over the green altar. He could not move or scream or feel. Out of the corner of one eye, he saw the thin, braceleted wrists of Juan and Concepcion. He heard Victor speak in a language he could not understand. His heart was leaping against his chest like a wild thing that had caught the scent of freedom.
Pleasant dreams, everybody. You're tuned to listeners. And if you're having a midnight snack, by the way, so much the better. We recommend the avocado salad. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York. New York City. My mind is like, you know, in nine directions at once. The name of that story is where I was going to go. Again, Paul, what was the name of it?
That story is called Maya Land.
Maya Land. And that is in Evermore.
Everland.
You see, I'm doing Maya Moore in Evermore or Everland in Maya Land.
Yes, exactly.
Maya Lansky. I don't know. It's Maya Land in Everland by Paul Witkover. By the way, WITCOVER. For those of you who weren't looking at the subtitling on your radios. And we think that's in print from PS Publishing, that book.
Yeah, it should still be available.
Yeah, so do take a look at it. The horror fiction has always given me it's. I have mixed feelings about it.
I do as well.
Yeah. I'm supposed to be moderating a panel at ReaderCon, which I think is Saturday, called "I'm Shocked at What People Are Doing Here." And on the panel is Charles Platt and a couple of other writers who've written some really visceral horror. Speaking of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, I will never forget Charles Platt reading a particular story that I think, in all the years of that reading series, creeped me out more than anything else. And so I'm looking forward to that panel.
Yeah, it's high praise.
It's high praise and yet thoroughly disgusted. But that's what's, you know, horror is. I once asked Ellen Datlow on this program, how do you define horror? And she says, well, it gives you a feeling of horror. And it's really one of the only genres that one can, you know, that's self-named.
Yeah.
You don't get a feeling of fantasy from fantastic stories. You certainly don't get a feeling of science fiction. Horror is intended to solicit, ghost stories aside and that kind of stuff, which aren't really horror necessarily.
Well, there's so many different kinds of horror.
Yeah. But that's a classic example, the one that you read there.
Yeah. That's probably the most straightforward horror story that I've written.
Yeah. Yeah. It does its job well.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing though about a horror story is that it does have a job to do. That's the purpose of a horror story is to do a job.
Yeah.
And that's
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could say that about any story, but a horror story, because it's in some respects is designed to evoke a visceral response, it's has a very clear-cut job to do.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. When you're reading science fiction, it's the sense of wonder. When it's been fantasy, it's feelings of awesomeness or whatever it may be. But horror is about horror. That's the goal. Speaking of awesomeness, hi, Lester.
How are you?
I am well. How are you doing, sir?
Good.
Yeah. How do you have an agenda for your show other than just great music this morning? Or is that that's what it's going to be, right?
Yeah, I'm going to try out this new type of marijuana.
Ooh. Ooh. Wait a minute. I'm not leaving the station in that case. Whoa. Wait a second. Okay.
Dinner for two and me.
Have fun. Oh, good God. Pseudo.
Oh, wow.
Your daughter's restaurant.
And her husband.
I would not have assumed that your daughter would be running a wine bar. That would not be the first thing. I would not take one look at you and say, this is somebody whose daughter has a wine bar. Not the, you know, Rasta. This is such a thing as Rasta food other than potato chips. And
I tried to bring her up as a Reed Hardcore communist, but, you know.
It just didn't take. We have like 5 minutes left before we have to go off. Do you want to see if anybody has anything wise to say out there?
Sure.
I'm sure there are wise people out there.
The wise ones are all asleep at this hour.
Well, except the real wise one, the Wiccans or whatever. They're pretty wise, right? Mm-hmm. The wise people, as opposed to the wise crackers. Whoa.
Well, those are the ones that have to be awake.
Exactly. The phone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And the rules are simple. Be on topic. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Witkover, that was a spiffy little unsettling story for 3 o'clock in the morning. I thank you.
Well, thank you.
As I said earlier, sweet dreams.
Yes. did you do a lot of research into Mayan lore for this?
I wouldn't say I did a lot, but I traveled through Guatemala and did a little research.
Have you read the... which I think is the best. There's about 5 or 6. But if you read the 1988 Ted Shedlock translation of the Popol Vuh, I would recommend that to you.
I have read the Popol Vuh, but I can't tell you offhand which version of it, which translation I've read. It's a remarkable book in any translation.
It is, actually. And the Spanish pretty much decimated it. I mean, they really had to do a lot of searching for recovering it. And I have to say that it's, and I will say this, Latin American mythology, you know, 20 years ago, 34 years ago, fantasy writers were doing a lot, as you know, in Celtic, Norse, Northern European, and then it sort of spread out. And I guess maybe the last 5 or 10 years, you're seeing a lot of, thank God, fantasy writers really topping into Central and South American, and I'm very happy about that, Mexican. And although I don't know, frankly, of any films that have been done on this. Do you?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was that Mel Gibson film. What was that called?
The Apocalypto.
Yeah, Apocalypto.
And then, I mean, going back to the ancient lore, so Werner Herzog's classic films set down there have, you know, there's at least one Herzog film.
Okay.
Is it Pizarro's soldiers?
You mean Aguirre, the Wrath of God?
That's it, Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
Oh. What did you say the other one was? Apocalypto?
Yes. Apocalypto, yeah.
Yeah. One last
and very, yeah, very quickly.
Yeah, about the Green Lantern, the one thing about the film that I found interesting, unlike other superheroes, it seems everybody knew his identity. You know, I mean, the superheroes seem to have an alter ego, an identity, you know, mild-mannered Peter Parker, Clark Kent, whatever. Everybody seemed to know Hal Jordan was Green Lantern. So
not really.
No?
Well, no, I mean, there aren't that many people in the movie who know Hal.
Yeah, I mean, in a comic book, nobody knows who
he is.
Nobody
knows, okay.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there's his girlfriend. Who else is there in the movie, you know? Out in at Oa, yeah.
Yeah, but that was a good, that was a nice scene with his girlfriend.
Oh, that was a fabulous scene. That was the best scene in the movie.
By the way, we're obviously getting set
We're out of time. Okay, yep, we lost there. Okay, but yeah, I wanted to see if we could grab one more call before we go off. Good morning, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, Jim.
Hi there.
Real quick, let me continue my Doctor Who rant.
Oh, okay.
Part two, why I don't like the new Doctor Who. He tries to be charming rather than being charming. And
I disagree, but go on.
Okay, and I don't think he's a very good actor.
You are so wrong.
No. This is what I think.
Well, okay, that's your opinion, but he has shown his acting chops in several...
Well, sometimes...
Well, I've seen him do a lot of things.
Okay, I haven't seen
him. Have you? What have you seen him in other than Doctor Who?
I haven't seen him in... well...
So you can't judge his performing capabilities, can you?
Okay. I just think he's kind of...
As a person who worked in an actor's agency, I'll say I know a little something about it.
It seems like he's a little bit barrel-chested and too tall.
Okay, so you don't have to love him. That's okay, but
like
this isn't
Colin Baker-esque. A little bit.
Well, you know, in case you haven't noticed, one of the things that he does that's so brilliant in his performance is he's managed to emulate every Doctor up to date.
I haven't seen the new season yet, but I must say...
Well, that was evident in the past season.
When I see it, I'll tell you.
Okay, very good.
Okay, I must say about...
we have 30 seconds.
I must say about Gene Colan, the best thing he ever did, and this is proof of it, is Nathaniel Dusk. He actually, and I think if Ken was here, he'd appreciate this.
Well, Ken will be here next week.
He had pencils that were colored, so there were no inks, and there were not even inks in his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just his pencils, and they colored the pencils. And it comes out, the effects are amazing. And someone said, like, oh, you know, he doesn't need
an inker. Remember that 30 seconds?
Nathaniel Dusk, second season, I think, not second season, second series.
Very good.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning. Okay. Because that leaves us with, the dusk of the show, as it were. You don't have a direct website, do you, Paul? At this point.
Not as such.
But if people want to find you online and things Paul Witkover, they could seek you on Facebook?
Sure. They can find me on Facebook I do have a webpage and people can find that just by Googling my name.
Yeah, which again is WITCOVER, first mm-hmm. name Paul. And it's been way too long since you've been here.
Well, I've had a great time. Thanks,
good.
Jim.
Yeah, it seems so accelerated at this hour. Now all the calls, you know, even more calls coming.
Right.
In. And by the way, I didn't mean to pull superiority over that last caller in the, well, is this a good actor or not? But, I mean, you may not like the performance. But whether or not Matt Smith can act, right. I don't think is that question.
That seemed like an ongoing conversation there.
No, I'm not even aware of the ongoing, you know. I get calls each week, and I try to deal with one as they come.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, it doesn't matter. We're not going to see any Doctor Who for another 6 months, darn it. So we're halfway through the season. So... I don't know exactly when I'll be back. Next week, Ken Gale will be sitting in this chair and discussing Gene Colan and probably discussing raising money for WBAI. But we don't have our fundraising schedule yet. When we do, we will know more. But I will certainly be back before August. When? Well, stay tuned. Thank you again. This has been Hour of the Wolf. I am Jim Freund. Thank you, Paul Witkover. And stay tuned for Burn, Baby, Burn, Clappers.
radio video. Boogie with a suitcase. No living in a disco. Forget about the rat race. Let's do the milkshake. You're selling like a hotcake. Try some, buy some, fee, five, four, five. Talk about pop music. Talk about pop music. I want to dedicate it. Everybody made it. Infiltrate it. Activate it. New York, London, Paris, Munich. Everybody talk about pop music.
That I've known Lister, I've only wanted one thing, that someday he would produce a reggae version of If I Only Had a Brain, and I know he will. I'm Randy Cohen. I write the ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, and you can listen to Lister on WUSB 90.1 FM in Stony Brook and Pacifica Radio WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
Tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM WBAI.org. 9 minutes after 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, Pacifica Radio at its very best. Jim Fry, nice show this afternoon, this morning, beg your pardon. Still stoned to the bone on my hydroponic burn baby burn style. Which reminds me, condolences from all of us right here at Pacifica Radio WBAI, the passing of Robert Knight's mother. Therefore, the show is dedicated to Robert Knight's beloved mother. Robert will cry for you. 99.5 Listen Alive. Feel your brother. Know what you're going through. And welcoming back, Sydney. You feeling good? I'm feeling good because you're back, Sydney, where you belong, right here. You know what I mean? Dedicating this to Robert Knight and Sydney and Robert Knight's mother. 10 minutes after 3 o'clock.